Before I begin today, let me remind you that I have a new book coming out before Christmas, possibly even by the end of November. The book's title is The Last Chapter, and it will retail for $28.95, including shipping, when it's published. I have commissioned a pre-sale on this book to make it available to you for $24.95, including shipping, for those who order before October 31st. It's important to get an idea of the demand for our printers. I spent a lot of time and research on this book, and it contains information the mainstream media doesn't tell you. The book also has a few of my weekly commentaries in it that people have requested. In this, my last book, I pull no punches. My thoughts about events and people over my 58-year broadcasting career will make some people happy, and others will be gnashing their teeth. As human beings, we tend to postpone things and then forget to follow through. That's why it's so important to order now, before procrastination sets in. And here's how to order my book. Send a check or money order for $24.95 to The Last Chapter, 3434-135, Box 176, Kildare Farm Road, Cary, North Carolina, 27518. Or you can order by credit card. Just call Adrian at the DeSillis Law Firm in Charlotte. That number is 980-265-2505. Again, 980-265-2505. If you did not catch all that, you can call my office for the information. That number is 919-387-7303. 919-387-7303. As with my previous five books, all profits from the sales will go to help our wounded warriors, this time to Tunnel to Towers Foundation that helps wounded vets get a home for their families. When you purchase this chapter, you're also showing your support for our veterans. If you've enjoyed my commentaries over the decades, you'll enjoy the last chapter. Order today, and let me know if you'd like to have it autographed. I'll be glad to do it. My commentary shortly, but first, Democrats take the American people for fools, and enough were fools to put Joe Biden into the presidency. Since then, nothing has gone well, and our borders are jammed with illegal immigrants. Our national debt is unsustainable now, and yet Democrats want to add trillions in more debt. They got more than $1 trillion for infrastructure. We need it for the roads and bridges. But still, they sought more than $3.5 trillion for increased social programs. They knew that would not get approval, but they started that high so that when it got reduced to maybe $2 trillion, people would think it was a bargain. The jury is still out on what the final figure will be, but they are placing a financial noose around the necks of our grandchildren. Democrats don't seem to be able to grasp how deep in debt we are in America. It does not seem to matter to them that the interest alone on the national debt will strangle us. I've made no secret of how I feel about today's Democrat Party. Their leaders lack common sense and are hell-bent on making America a socialist country. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, these radicals are supposed to lead the country? This list sounds more like the FBI's most wanted. They did get Biden into the Oval Office, and my commentary today will focus on how that brings us closer to war with China. And I share my commentary today. I share credit with Hal Brands and Michael Beckley of Foreign Policy for their contributions and research. Why do great powers fight great wars? The conventional answer is a story of rising challengers and declining powers. An ascendant power, which chafes at the rules of the existing order, gains ground on an established power, the country that made those rules. Tensions multiply. Tests of strength ensue. And the outcome is a spiral of fear and hostility, leading almost inevitably to conflict. The growth of the power of Athens and the alarm which this inspired in Sparta made war there inevitable. The ancient historian Thucydides wrote, a truism now invoked, ad nauseum, in explaining the U.S.-China rivalry. The idea of a Thucydides trap, popularized by Harvard political scientist Graham Allison, holds that the danger of war will skyrocket as a surging China overtakes a sagging America. Even China President Xi Jinping has endorsed the concept, arguing that Washington must make room for Beijing. As tensions between the U.S. and China escalate, the belief that the fundamental cause of friction is a looming power transition, the replacement of one power by another, has become widespread. The only problem with this familiar formula is that it's wrong. The Thucydides trap does not really explain what caused the Peloponnesian War. It doesn't capture the dynamics that have often driven revisionist powers, whether that's Germany in 1914 or Japan in 1941, to start some of the history's most devastating conflicts. And it does not explain why war is a very real possibility in U.S.-China relations today, because it fundamentally misdiagnoses where China now finds itself on its arc of development, the point at which its relative power is peaking and will soon start to fade. There is indeed a deadly trap that could ensnare the United States and China, but it's not the product of a power transition the Thucydidean cliché tells us it is. It's best thought of instead as a peaking power trap, and if history is any guide, it's China's, not the United States, whose impending decline could cause it to snap. There is a body of work underpinning the Thucydides trap, and there is, admittedly, an elemental truth to the idea. The rise of new powers is invariably destabilizing. In the run-up to the Peloponnesian War in the 5th century B.C., Athens would not have seemed so menacing to Sparta had it not built a vast empire and become a naval superpower. Washington and Beijing would not be locked in rivalry if China was still poor and weak. Rising powers do expand their influence in ways that threaten reigning powers. But the calculus that produces war, particularly the calculus that pushes revisionist powers, countries seeking to shake up the existing system to lash out violently, is more complex. A country whose relative wealth and power are growing will surely become more assertive and ambitious. All things equal, it will seek greater global influence and prestige. But if its position is steadily improving, it should postpone a deadly showdown with the reigning power until it has become even stronger. Such a country should follow the dictum former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping laid down for a rising China after the Cold War. He said it should hide its capabilities and bide its time. Now, imagine a different scenario, a dissatisfied state that has been building its power and expanding its geopolitical horizons. But then the country peaks, perhaps because its economy slows, perhaps because its own assertiveness provoked a coalition of determined rivals, or perhaps because both of these things happen at once. The future then starts to look quite forbidding. A sense of imminent danger starts to replace a feeling of limitless possibility. In these circumstances, a revisionist power may act broadly, boldly, even aggressively, to grab what it can before it's too late. The most dangerous trajectory in world politics is a long rise followed by the prospect of a sharp decline. This scenario is more common than you might think. Over the past 150 years, peaking powers, great powers that had been growing dramatically faster than the world average and then suffered severe prolonged slowdowns, usually don't fade away quietly. Rather, they become brash and aggressive. They suppress dissent at home and try to regain economic momentum by creating exclusive spheres of influence abroad. They pour money into their militaries and use force to expand their influence. This behavior commonly provokes great power tensions. In some cases, it touches off disastrous wars. This should not be surprising. Eras of rapid growth supercharge a country's ambitions, raise its people's expectations, and make its rivals nervous. During a sustained economic boom, businesses enjoy rising profits, and citizens get used to living large. The country then becomes a bigger player on the global stage. And then stagnation strikes. Slowing growth makes it harder for leaders to keep the public happy. Economic underperformance weakens the country against its rivals. Fearing upheaval, leaders crack down on dissent. They maneuver desperately to keep geopolitical enemies at bay. Expansion seems like a solution, a way of grabbing economic resources and markets, making nationalism a crutch for a wounded regime, and beating back foreign threats. Many countries have followed this path. When the United States' long post-Civil War economic surge ended, Washington violently suppressed strikes and unrest at home. They built a blue water navy, a powerful navy, and engaged in a fit of belligerence and imperial expansion during the 1890s. After a fast-rising imperial Russia fell into a deep slump at the turn of the 20th century, the Tsarist government cracked down hard while also enlarging its military, seeking colonial gains in East Asia and sending around 170,000 soldiers to occupy Manchuria. These moves backfired on them spectacularly. They antagonized Japan, which then beat Russia in the first great power war of the 20th century. A century later, Russia became aggressive under similar circumstances, facing a severe post-2008 economic slowdown. Russian President Vladimir Putin invaded two neighboring countries, sought to create a new Eurasian economic bloc, staked Moscow's claim to a resource-rich Arctic, and steered Russia deeper into dictatorship. Even democratic France got involved after the end of its post-war economic expansion in the 1970s. It tried to rebuild its old sphere of influence in Africa, deploying 14,000 troops to its former colonies and undertaking a dozen military interventions over the next two decades. All these cases were complicated, yet the pattern is clear. If a rapid rise gives countries the means to act boldly, the fear of decline serves up a powerful motive for rasher, more urgent expansion. The same thing often happens when fast-rising powers cause their own containment by a hostile coalition. In fact, some of history's most gruesome wars have come when revisionist powers concluded their path to glory was about to be blocked. Imperial Germany and Japan are textbook examples. Germany's rivalry with Britain in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is often considered an analog to the U.S.-China competition. In both cases, an autocratic challenger, threatened a liberal power. But the more sobering parallel is this. War came when a cornered Germany grasped that it would never zip past its rivals without a fight. For decades after unification in 1871, Germany soared. Its factories spewed out iron and steel, erasing Britain's economic lead. Berlin built Europe's finest army and battleships and threatened British supremacy at sea. By the early 1900s, Germany was a European heavyweight, seeking an enormous sphere of influence on the continent. It was also pursuing, under then-Kaiser Wilhelm II, a world policy aimed at securing colonies and global power. But during the prelude to war, the Kaiser and his aides didn't feel very confident. Germany's brash behavior caused its encirclement by hostile powers. London, Paris, and St. Petersburg, Russia, formed a triple power to block German expansion. By 1914, time was running short. Germany was losing ground economically to a fast-growing Russia. London and France were pursuing economic containment by blocking Germany's access to oil and iron ore. Berlin's key ally, Austria-Hungary, was being torn apart by ethnic tensions. At home, Germany's autocratic political system was in deep trouble. Most ominous, the military balance was shifting. France was enlarging its army, Russia was adding 470,000 men to its military and slashing the time it needed to mobilize for war. Britain announced that it would build two battleships for every one built by Berlin. Germany was, for the moment, Europe's foremost military power. But by 1916 and 1917, it would be hopelessly overmatched. The result was a now-or-never mentality. Germany should defeat the enemy while we still have a chance of victory, declared Chief of Staff Helmuth von Moltke, even if it means provoking war in the near future. That's what happened after Serbian nationalists assassinated Austria's crown prince in 1914. The Kaiser's government urged Austria-Hungary to crush Serbia, even though that would mean war with Russia and France. It then invaded neutral Belgium, the key to its plan for a two-front war, despite the likelihood of provoking Britain. Germany's rise had given it the power to gamble for greatness. Its impending decline drove the decisions that plunged the world into war. Imperial Japan followed a similar trajectory. For a half century after the Meiji Restoration in 1868, Japan was rising steadily. The building of a modern economy and a fierce military allowed Tokyo to win two major wars and accumulate colonial privileges in China, Taiwan, and the Korean Peninsula. Yet, Japan was not a hyper-belligerent predator. Through the 1920s, it cooperated with the United States, Britain, and other countries to create a cooperative security framework in the Asia-Pacific. During that decade, however, things fell apart. Growth dropped from 6.1% annually between 1904 and 1919 to 1.8% annually in the 1920s. The Great Depression then shut down Japan's overseas markets. Unemployment soared in Japan, and bankrupt farmers were left to sell their daughters. In China, meanwhile, Japanese influence was being challenged by the Soviet Union and a rising nationalist movement under then-Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek. Tokyo's answer was to build a greater empire, and the result drew a noose around Tokyo's neck. From the late 1920s onward, The military conducted a slow-motion coup and harnessed the nation's resources for total war. Japan initiated a massive military buildup and violently established a sphere of influence, seizing Manchuria in 1931, invading China in 1937, and laying plans to conquer resource-rich colonies and strategic islands across the Asia Pacific. Japan's push into China eventually led to a punishing war with the Soviet Union. Japan's design on Southeast Asia alarmed Britain. Its drive for regional primacy also made it a foe of the United States, and the United States was the country from which Tokyo imported nearly all of its oil, with an economy vastly larger than Japan's. Tokyo had antagonized an overwhelming coalition of enemies, and it then risked everything rather than accepting humiliation and decline. Losing faith is a powerful thing for the Japanese. The precipitating cause, again, was a closing window of opportunity. By 1941, the United States was building an unbeatable military. In July, then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt imposed an oil embargo that threatened to stop Japan's expansion in its tracks. But Japan still had a temporary military edge in the Pacific Ocean, thanks to its early rearmament. So it used that advantage in a lightning attack, seizing the Dutch East Indies, the Philippines, and other possessions from Singapore to Wake Island, as well as bombing the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor, which guaranteed its own destruction. Japan's prospects for victory were dim, acknowledged then-Japanese General Hideki Tojo. Yet, there was no choice for us but to close our eyes and jump, he said. A revisionist Japan became most violent when it saw that time was running out on them. This is the real trap the United States should worry about regarding China today. The trap in which an aspiring superpower peaks and then refuses to bear the painful consequences of their descent. China's rise is no mirage. Decades of growth have given Beijing the economic sinews of global power. Major investments in key technologies and communications infrastructure have yielded a strong position in the struggle for geoeconomics and influence. China is using a multi-continent Belt and Road initiative to bring other states into its own orbit. Most alarming, think tank assessments and the U.S. Defense Department reports show China's increasingly formidable military now does stand a real chance of winning a war against the United States in the Western Pacific. The election of Joe Biden in 2020 has increased China's odds. It is unsurprising, therefore, that China has also developed the ambitions of a superpower. Xi has more or less announced that Beijing desires to assert its sovereignty over Taiwan, the South China Sea, and other disputed areas, becoming Asia's preeminent power and challenging the United States for global leadership. Yet, if China's geopolitical window of opportunity is real, its future is already starting to look quite dim, because it is quickly losing the advantages that propelled its rapid growth. For example, China is running out of resources. Water has become very scarce, and the country is importing more energy and food than any other nation, having ravaged its own natural resources. To be clear, China probably will not undertake an all-out military rampage across Asia, as Japan did in the 1930s and early 1940s. but it will run greater risks and accept greater tensions as it tries to lock in key gains they've made. Welcome to geopolitics in the age of a peaking China, a country that already has the ability to violently change the existing order, and one that will probably run faster and push harder as it loses confidence that time is on its side. The United States, then, will face not one, but two tasks in dealing with China in the 2020s. It will have to continue mobilizing for long-term competition, while also moving quickly to deter aggression and blunt some of the more aggressive, near-term moves Beijing may make. In other words, buckle up. The United States has been rousing itself to deal with a rising China. It's about to discover that a declining China may be even more dangerous to us. When Democrats became so hate-filled against Donald Trump, they either did not consider the consequences of putting this feeble-minded, inept Joe Biden into the White House, and what that means for our enemies. They feared an unpredictable Donald Trump. They do not fear a predictable Joe Biden. And so, North Korea has begun testing more missiles, and China has stepped up its harassment of Taiwan. None of that was happening under Donald Trump's watch. Like him or hate him, the man's policies were in the best interests of the United States. Both countries, North Korea and China, see the Biden administration as weak and unstable, and that makes war more inevitable. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next weekend, God willing. Same time and same station. And God bless America.